Today we are talking about a night in Cologne's history that was so strange that even a battle-hardened count took to his heels. Plus treacherous priests, arsonists, workers in Cologne's harbor district, and armed weavers, all here in this single episode. Count Diedrich von Kleve couldn't sleep that night of 12 September 1265. Together with the army of the Archbishop of Cologne, he had been besieging the rebellious city of Cologne and its arrogant inhabitants for around a week, who were once again at odds with their God-given overlord, Archbishop Engelbert II von Falkenburg. Even in the 13th century, people knew this. If you can't sleep at night, there's no point in tossing and turning in bed. So the Count of Kleve got up and stepped out of the tent into the open air. A short walk would hopefully clear his mind. Diedrich had enough to worry about. Would the Archbishop's plan work out so that his agents in the city could secretly open the gates from the inside for him? Or would the siege go on even longer? After all, autumn was fast approaching. The Count of Kleve walked through the sleeping army camp, which lay at safe distance in front of Cologne's city walls. What Diedrich was doing now was actually pretty stupid. He left the sleeping army camp and walked towards the city wall under the cover of the dark night. As I said, a pretty stupid idea, because if one of the people of Cologne caught sight of him from the wall, whoops, no telling what kind of danger he would be in. But as I said, it was a dark night, and there were no searchlights for a long time yet that had been invented. The Count of Kleve sat down for a moment on a large stone next to a meadow and gazed at the largest medieval city wall in Europe. And then something strange happened. A light approached him, traveling along the city wall, walking outside of the city wall. But wait, he thought, not just one light, several small lights. And not only that, it became dozens of lights, and then thousands. Count Diedrich rubbed his eyes, he felt dizzy. And yet now he saw it clearly. 11,000 young women in old-fashioned dresses, which were completely alien to his 13th century time, walked along the city wall singing, each with a candle in her hand that was lit. And they blessed every meter of Cologne city wall with hand gestures as they walked around it. And they completely ignored the Count, who was watching them from a very close distance. The Count of Kleve jumped up and ran for his life back to the camp. If only he could lead his army to battle against sinful men, even a man of his high rank did not dare to fight Saint Ursula, Holy Ursula, and her companions. The next morning, he packed his belongings and left Cologne with his own army, and left his ally, the Archbishop of Cologne, speechless. According to the Cologne city clerk Gottfried Hagen, the city's writer, this event really did take place in September 1265. Whether you believe it or not is of course up to you, but that's what the Count of Kleve said that he saw that night, and he really left after that. But how did it happen that Cologne was once again besieged, and by their own city ruler? Strange. Let's find out in this episode. Before we get to the events that happened in the intro, we have to go back a few years. It is the end of November 1263, the place and date where we left in the last episode, and Engelbert von Falkenburg, the actually powerful archbishop and city lord of Cologne, the great imperial prince who crowned kings in Aachen, had been captured. He was guarded round the clock in a parlor in a house called Zum Ross, to the horse in English, in the Rheingasse Alley. It was another turning point in the never-ending dispute between the city and the Archbishop as their secular lord. And yet this episode was to show what I often neglect for narrative reasons, the constellation, the simple constellation of citizens versus Archbishop, was not always so simple. Despite finding himself in an awkward position, Engelbert would take his 3-year battle against the Cologne dynasties, the patricians, to a new level. Treacherous priests, arsonists, workers in the harbor district, and armed weavers would help him on his way to becoming the absolute ruler of Cologne. The question is, will he succeed? And with that, welcome back to The History of Cologne, a podcast about the history of Cologne that is over 2,000 years old. But until it became what it is today, this old city on the Rhine has endured a colorful and rich past, hence it can therefore be seen as a microcosm of European history. In this podcast, you can listen as the city grows from the Romans up until our present time. So, again, what happened in the last episode? Engelbert II suffered a fate that no Archbishop of Cologne had ever had to endure in this form before. Sure, he was not the first Archbishop that got caught. Remember, his predecessor, Konrad von Hochstein, had spent a whole 9 months in captivity, but at the hands of a nobleman of the same rank. What had happened to him, Engelbert II von Falkenburg, was a novelty. He was captured by his own subjects. He, who had actually wanted to initiate a major coup plan in his own favor, had himself become the victim of such a thing. At the end of November 1263, 37 men from the Cologne citizenry had taken him by surprise in his palace by the cathedral in Cologne, captured him, and dragged him halfway across the city into their chamber in Rheingasse Alley. The location of his capture, Rheingasse, funnily enough, a place where there's a really great ramen store where I love to eat Japanese noodles, but I digress, gives us an important clue as to who exactly could have been behind the crime, who were the kidnappers. Then as now, the alley was located in the immediate southern neighborhood of Heumarkt Square. As I said, a great ramen place is there, I love to go there. And who lived there? Come on. We covered this before, who lived in that street. The Oberstolzen family, the powerful patrician family whose house can still be found there today. The street was also home to other allies of the Oberstolzen, the Jude family and the Haderfusts. In addition to their mutual support, these families had something else in common. They were all represented by family members on Cologne's up-and-coming city council. This was preparing to become the city's highest civic political body alongside the Richterzeche and the Collegiate of Jurors. The hitherto dominant family of the wise man from the Mühlengasse, who continued to base their power on having their family members all stacked in the Collegiate of Jurors or Magistrates, were probably not directly involved. As noble as these citizens of Cologne considered themselves to be, for the noble Engelbert von Falkenburg, a nobleman after all, they were, of course, part of the mob that held him prisoner. He did not find his capture by them at all amusing. And while still in prison, he excommunicated his 37 captors and made the entire city jointly responsible. An interdict was imposed on the city, meaning no more acts of worship are permitted in Cologne. What quite a few people would probably shrug their shoulders about today was something quite terrible back then. Newborns were not baptized. They were therefore not part of the congregation, and if they died unbaptized, they would carry the original sin of Adam and Eve from birth in their entirety. The same applied to burials. These were carried out by the church and not by a state institution as is the case today. Do you want to bury your nearest and dearest so that they can ascend to heaven or give the last rites beforehand? That is not allowed either during an interdict. Too bad about the immortal soul that is now burning in hell because of it. For the people of that time and far beyond, the interdict was a severe punishment as the church fulfilled many tasks that a modern state would do nowadays. And they had no choice. There was only that one Christian church, the Catholic Church. And for the archbishops of that time, being a secular ruler as well, it was a favorite tool of power to use in political disputes. Of course, the reality in Cologne on the street was different. Some priests continued to work despite the interdict, out of charity or simply out of disobedience. We will learn more about this later elsewhere. But what was to happen next? We were stuck here in Cologne once again. The archbishop was trapped, held prisoner, but what was the point if no results were achieved, or worse still, an interdict was imposed on the city? And yes, I'm beginning to be afraid to say it again. They agreed on another atonement to get along. I've honestly stopped counting the number of attempts since the last podcast episode. So after 20 days in prison, which may not be in prison, being held captive, which means Engelbert can just about celebrate Christmas, a new atonement is written by the Cologne town writer Gottfried Hagen on 16th December 1263. The scope of these disputes far beyond the city can be seen from the people involved in this dispute settlement. In other words, this attempted settlement of the dispute, because none had ever lasted before, Engelbert had always cancelled it shortly after. A pattern we will hear often now. The Count of Geldern and the Count of Jülich, as well as the bishops of Liège and Münster, took part in it. All bishopric subjects to the Archbishopric of Cologne, too. So Münster, Osnabrück, Minden, Liège, Cambrai and Utrecht, all city lords and vassals in the Archbishopric of Cologne, as well as the clerical leadership of the Cologne Church, including the Cologne Cathedral Chapter, all of them were also made responsible. They were all supposed to ensure that the agreements between both parties, between the citizenry and the archbishop, were honored. And in particular, that the Archbishop of Cologne did not break them again. Furthermore, the archbishop had to honor and respect all previous agreements in the atonement's treaties. He was to revoke the interdict against the city and the penalties imposed on priests in Cologne who, I said that already, who had nevertheless acted on the basis of the interdict. His kidnappers were to go unpunished. And yes, we always depict the archbishop as a ooh-hoo-hoo bad guy, but I can understand that the archbishop did not like this segment of the treaty. I would be pissed about that as well. My captives go unpunished? What? This was, of course, completely humiliating for Engelbert von Falkenburg, and since honor and prestige were everything in those days, Engelbert was granted something that would preserve his rank and status. He was again paid a sum of money, this time 4,000 marks. And what can I say, dear people? I'm getting tired of it too. Of course, Engelbert didn't honor the agreement again. On the contrary, as soon as he was released after signing the atonement, he went back on a warlike confrontation course. I'll cut a long story short for the sake of all our souls. For logical reasons, Engelbert II did not feel safe in Cologne. He settled in Bonn, south of Cologne, for the time being, and did something that he was no longer authorized to do by several legal judgments. He summoned his 37 kidnappers from Cologne from November 1263 to appear before his court in Bonn, in another city, so to speak. They were to be tried there, but this, however, as you know from earlier episodes, violated the right of ius de non evocando, which had already been repeatedly recognized by kings and popes and the archbishops of Cologne themselves, because according to this law, no citizen of Cologne was allowed to be dragged before a non-Cologne court for offenses they had allegedly committed in the city of Cologne. Engelbert broke this rule, and oh wonder, none of the 37 Cologne kidnappers at the time turned up for the trial in Bonn. The result, you can imagine, excommunication for those 37, and of course the whole city of Cologne was taken hostage again. This means that the interdict over the city is active again. No more acts of worships are allowed. I would really love to know why Engelbert was so determined to always strike immediately. His predecessor Konrad von Hochstaden had always waited for the right situation to strike against the rising citizenry with a great deal of cunning but also patience, and as we learned, successfully so. Engelbert, however, seemed hell-bent on creating stress at every moment of his episcopate, without really taking a strategic approach, or how do you see it? The Pope also backed him up for the first time in 1264. According to the head of the church, Engelbert did not have to abide by the atonement regulations that had been done, as Engelbert had been in captivity at the time, and these provisions had been imposed on him by force to the detriment of the Church of Cologne, and therefore invalid. Although, in my opinion, the Pope was even somewhat right, as a prisoner, Engelbert's negotiation positions had not really been the best, to be honest. How could this go on? We had a time when Anno II was Archbishop of Cologne, so almost exactly 200 years earlier. We once explained the term feud during his time. For a long time, a so-called feud was a right that was granted for the nobility. If one count, for example, felt wronged by another, they did not go to court or appeal to the emperor. No, after settling the formalities, they waged a private war against each other and ravaged the lands of their opponent. It really was something like that. You had a messenger, sent him to your opponent with a letter that's telling them, hey, I will start a war with you in 3 days, okay? And the other side said, okay, let's do it. That would be like if the Mülheim district of Cologne sending its employees into the city center of Cologne to devastate the Hochstraße shopping street in order to persuade the mayor to finally speed up the renovation of the broken Mülheim Bridge, which has been a permanent construction site in nowadays Cologne for years, and makes it extremely difficult for the people in Mülheim to cross to the other side of the Rhine. The Archbishop of Cologne and the city of Cologne remained in exactly this position. They had a feud. Engelbert II was always somehow around Cologne, mostly Bonn, looking for the next opportunity to strike. The status of a feud between the two sides also suggests that Cologne declared other powerful foreign rulers in the region to be citizens of the city of Cologne. You learned the purpose of that system in the previous podcast episode. On 31st August 1264, the nobleman Friedrich von Reifferscheid zu Bedburg, and on 28th October of the same year, Gerhard von Isenburg zu Ahrenfels were made citizens of the city of Cologne, exactly for that purpose, to have a better defensive shield for the city. However, not all rulers in the Rhineland were interested in a long war for the time being. The Count of Jülich and representatives of the Cologne Church once again brought the two parties to the dispute together. And yes, I'll spare you the details. Peace was made again on 8th March 1265, and the treaty agreements on atonement were almost identical. The archbishop was only accommodated in one respect this time. His captors from November 1263 had to come to the city in the most humiliating manner, scantily clad and barefoot. For good reason, Engelbert no longer dared to enter Cologne. On the so-called Judenbüche, a field outside of Cologne, which had also the Jewish cemetery, today located in the southern district of Raderberg in Cologne, they, those 37 captives, had to throw themselves to the ground in supplication and beg the city lord for forgiveness. Then they had to say that they had kidnapped him spontaneously, without a plan and out of stupidity, that they had immediately regretted it, and should the archbishop ever come to Cologne again, entering the city, they would have to wait for him at the southern city gate, the Severinstor gate, and accompany him into the city to his palace as his bodyguard, but in a role that's more close to being servants, wearing exactly the same scanty clothing without bells or headgear and barefoot. And as I said, honor is everything in the Middle Ages. The fact that these 37 men were humiliated like this in front of all their fellow neighbors was a severe punishment. These influential Cologne men, however, would never forget it. The Archbishop probably didn't care. For him, it was more important to present himself as the all-embracing ruler of the city. Well, we will see about that in a moment. Who were these 37 men anyway that had captured the Archbishop in the last episode? Based on the place they had chosen as a prison for Engelbert, we had localized them in the ranks of the patrician families around the Overstolzens, Haderfuss, and Judas. Those patrician families who used the comparatively young Cologne city council to get to the top of the city, in competition with the family of the wise man from the Mühlengasse, who continued to consolidate their power in the old collegiate of magistrates, which was beholden to the Archbishop after all. But we do not know the exact names of the individual men. In addition to the punishment of having to behave in the most submissive manner towards the Archbishop, they were given another punishment. They had to travel on foot, divided into groups, to various places and ask, therefore, forgiveness of their sins there as pilgrims as well. Only when these 37 men had done this, a week-long adventure, this would be the time when the Archbishop would forgive them, lift the excommunication, and above all, only then would lift the interdict on the entire city. Until their return, all acts of worship such as baptisms, funerals, weddings, etc. would remain forbidden. As I said, let's abbreviate here, for as soon as this document had been drawn up, it was no longer worth the parchment on which it was written. Because really only a few weeks later, I know it's making me tired as well, Engelbert II again breaks this treaty, this atonement. He is now even more aggressive, with a powerful lever that Konrad von Hochstaden, his predecessor in office, had once used. Let's take a step back again. I always speak of the citizens of Cologne fighting against their archbishop. But it is always true that I am only talking about the richest citizens in the city. And even they are not homogeneous. We have known this at least since Konrad von Hochstaden's archbishopric, when he skillfully brought the brotherhoods in Cologne, so the craft guilds, onto his side a few years earlier as the, what did we call them, the alliance of the unhappy, the unsatisfied, the whatever we call them. These brotherhoods had also achieved some prosperity and were effectively the upper middle class in Cologne. However, they had not reached the higher circles of the jurors, the Richterzeche, or the city council, or the ones of the magistrates. In terms of wealth, they perhaps did not come close to the patricians, but in terms of the number of the members, those craft guilds were more than just professional organizations. They were sworn brotherhoods, celebrated religious festivals together, and stood by each other, even in the truest sense of the word. It is true that Engelbert von Falkenburg had fallen out with the brotherhoods at the beginning of his reign over Cologne, let's not forget that, but now he ventured a new advance. Textile production was a major economic factor in Cologne. Cologne was a major economic player in the Middle Ages. Consequently, many people were active in this field in Cologne, be it dyers, tanners, weavers, combmakers, or tailors. They brought the city a lot of money. However, they had little share in the political power segment. This caused dissatisfaction. And the Archbishop, who was chased out of the city, exploited this shamelessly among those Cologne citizens. Of course, Engelbert II was unable to publicly intrigue himself. That would have been too conspicuous. And after all the events, he was certainly under close scrutiny from everyone around him. And so the choice fell on a high official of the Archbishop of Cologne named Anselm von Justingen. His secret mission? To cause unrest in Cologne. In May 1265, just a few weeks after swearing to keep the peace, again, Engelbert's agent traveled to Cologne from neighboring town of Brühl. And oh wonder, I had already described it, the weavers were won over to an uprising against the patricians very easily. But what would the uprising look like? Because it would be noticeable if hundreds of armed men suddenly marched on in the streets of Cologne. But Anselm had a devious plan that sadly would end in a bloodbath. We all love the month of May. Especially me, because it's my birthday month. Most people love May because of all the public holidays. Furthermore, spring slowly turns into summer during this month. You can finally spend a lot of time in the fresh air again, and the days are light for longer. And May naturally invites you to dance. So a dance party should be organized, an ideal opportunity. People come together en masse without being noticed in a negative way. So the weavers invite all the other guild members, and other guilds as well, to a joint dance. While most invitations to such events nowadays say something like what dress code applies, this dance on 31st May of 1265 had a very special dress code. The men were required to come armed. Of course, the patricians were not stupid. They were, of course, aware of what was written on the invitation. They tried with all their might to ban this dance party, but the weavers simply said, well, we've already invited them, and if our servants decide to come armed, who are we to stop these young lads? So, tragedy struck in Weißbütgengasse Alley, in the Greeks Market neighborhood. Unfortunately, the street where it happened in the Middle Ages no longer exists in nowadays Cologne. During the Second World War, the small street of Weißbütgengasse was bombed to rubble. After the war, the street was not rebuilt, and this was deliberately exploited to build a path for the new big Rhine bridge through the old city center, the Severinsbrücke. Here on 31st May of 1265, the people of Cologne fought against the people of Cologne. Here in today's Griechenmarktviertel, where now a big bridge is standing, they were fighting and slaughtering each other, the guilds and the weavers against the patricians and their supporters. Exact figures are missing, of course, but according to Gottfried Hagen, the city writer, the guilds led by the weavers lost the battle, although they were represented in greater numbers than the supporters of the patricians. The smoldering conflict between the patricians and craft guilds, often neglected here in the podcast due to lack of historical sources, came to a bloody end on 31st May 1265 for the next 100 years. For the first time, the craftsmen guilds would not recover so quickly from this defeat. And so, the path of the patrician families to supremacy in the city of Cologne had taken another important step forward. This is often forgotten in historical depictions, as it is usually subtracted from archbishop versus citizens. So, now the craft guilds were out of the way for the patricians, only the archbishop was left. Now you might think that the conflict instigated by Engelbert von Falkenburg must have pleased the archbishop. Cologne townspeople murdering each other. But no, the whole thing was a disaster for Engelbert. He had completely sided with the craft guilds, however, they had proved to be too weak and perhaps technically too disorganized. And I know it's getting on my nerves as well. For the umpteenth time, Engelbert backed down a few weeks later. After the bloody events of 31st May 1265 in the city, he informed the Pope on 19th June that he no longer wanted to be at odds with Cologne and asked the Pope that the interdict on the city should no longer apply. And yet, unbelievable, isn't it? The archbishop did not let up. He traveled to Soest and consulted with his vassals and subordinates there. Remember, the archbishop of Cologne doesn't only rule over the city of Cologne, he has a vast territory in the Rhineland and in Westphalia. And among those vassals he consulted with was also the Count of Kleve from the intro. We know how they came to an agreement. Although the Archbishop had now failed countless times to take over the city by force, he attempted something that had not been successful since the Vikings in the 9th century. The violent overcoming of the city wall through a direct military attack on Cologne. And so on 5th September 1265, the storm bells rang in the district houses in the wards in Cologne. The people of Cologne would arm themselves with a spear and a leathern armor. Richer citizens even had swords and iron armor, and they would all gather in front of their respective district houses in the wards that where they lived there. Once they had rallied up there, they went to their designated segment of the wall that was assigned to them as a district. The Jewish Quarter, for example, a ward of its own in Cologne, had also its own section which the Jews of Cologne had to defend. They meant the section directly adjacent to the northeastern land side of the city wall on the banks of the Rhine. And when the inhabitants of Cologne stood on the city wall and saw the besieging army of the Archbishop and his allies, like the Count of Kleve as well, they had no idea that the enemy was not only lurking outside the city, but also in their midst. Engelbert of Falkenburg was aware of one thing. The largest medieval city wall in Europe at that time could not be overcome so easily. Therefore, he had once again hatched a plan to gain an advantage. This time, instead of hiring an advisor to the archbishop, sending him into the city, he recruited some people from among the Cologne citizenry. A man called Heinrich, the parish priest of the large parish church of St. Columba, not far from Cologne Cathedral, and a man called Wolfhard, a member of the Teutonic Order that was still very young at that time and still exists to this day. So, two clergymen. Who would have thought that the archbishop would do something like that? Those two clergymen bribed three workers at the harbor who were measuring salt for the city. They were to set fire to houses in the harbor district, so today's Martin's Quarter. This would cause the necessary chaos in the city. The men on the walls would move off the city wall to extinguish the fire at the harbor, because, as today, fires were the danger for a city in those days, especially in the most densely built up part of the city directly on the Rhine. The archbishop's warships were to occupy the Rhine in front of the city and also create the impression that the enemy would dare to attack the city wall on the riverside. This would leave the land side undefended, where the majority of the archbishop's army was still camping. In the chaos and confusion, some members of the recently defeated Weaver Guild would then open the city gates from the inside, allowing the archbishop's troops to enter. A good plan, actually. From a military point of view, no city wall in the world, no matter how big, will work if there aren't enough people to defend it. But perhaps, please don't take this statement too seriously, Saint Ursula really did watch over the city as its patron saint. Because in fact, and this is no legend, the Count of Kleve withdrew his army prematurely. According to Gottfried Hagen's story, he actually believed that he had a vision that Saint Ursula and her companions would defend the city. And, you know, it's better not to mess with saints. Count Dietrich didn't want to end up like Attila the Hun. And it really did seem as if the city's patron saint was watching over Cologne. More. Engelbert II would have to join the long list of those who would not be able to conquer Cologne militarily for many centuries to come, because everything went wrong with the plan that he had in mind. Those two clergymen were probably so stupid in executing the plan that they were quickly seized and arrested, and so were their accomplices within the city. The harbor district did not catch fire, and the city gates were not opened from the inside. The archbishop's army camped outside the city for 8 days for nothing. On 13 September 1265, the army left and retreated to Bonn, which had become somewhat the archbishop's favorite place of residence now that Cologne was out of reach for him. On 4th October of the same year of 1265, surprise, surprise, I know, a new verdict of atonement was agreed on. It actually said, hey, let's just do what we had always promised each other before, this time for real. The archbishop upheld the rights of the citizens, and the citizens continued to recognize him as the city's ruler and supreme judge. The interdict on the city was lifted, and religious services were also permitted again in 1266 after a few months' delay. Blessed by the Pope in Rome, baptisms, weddings, and funerals were finally allowed again. But nobody in Cologne believed in the sincerity of the city's ruler anymore, and that the atonement would stand this time. Someone would be very stupid if he did so. With the Count of Geldern, another nobleman from the Rhenish nobility was appointed a citizen of the city of Cologne at that time, another ally for the city in the battle to preserve its now hard-won autonomy. And yet, peace and quiet descended. Really? Engelbert certainly never lost sight of the fact that he wanted to control Cologne completely. But the Count of Jülich, a great ally of the city of Cologne, had become more and more of a threat to the archbishop now. Now he had to deal with it. In the autumn of 1267, Engelbert made a preemptive strike, invaded the territory of the Count of Jülich, which lay to the west of Cologne, and the possessions of the Cologne church. As I said, a so-called feud started. Initially, things went quite well for the Archbishop of Cologne. He took several villages from the Count of Jülich, but then Engelbert II made a mistake, a drastic mistake. He was captured by Count William of Jülich in a battle near Zülpich in the same autumn of 1267. I have to hand it to Engelbert. He did instigate a lot of violence during his lifetime. As a nobleman, however, he was naturally not above taking part in the fighting himself. When the Jülich Count's warriors surrounded him, taking him prisoner, Engelbert was not in a fine padded tent facing his opponents or even in a comfortable sedan chair. No, he was standing in the middle of the battlefield with a sword and full armor and had joined in the bloody action for hours. When he was captured by the warriors of the Count of Jülich, he saw some familiar faces from his own city. For citizens of Cologne also had joined the troops of Jülich to fight against him, Engelbert von Falkenburg, the city lord of Cologne. This brings us now full circle in this podcast episode. Captured in his palace in Cologne in 1263 by his own citizens, Engelbert found himself in the same predicament again in 1267. He was imprisoned again. And the rebellious people of Cologne had also had a hand in this, albeit only in part this time. Let's leave it at that for today. Thanks to your tips via PayPal, to Antje, Mark, Andreas, Christian, Bettina, Jörg, Silvia, Karin, and another Christian. And I used the following literature: Köln im Hochmittelalter, or Cologne in the High Middle Ages by Hugo Stehkämper and Karl Dietmar. Also Manfred Gotens' Köln im 13. Jahrhundert, or Manfred Gotens' Cologne in the 13th Century. Manfred Goten in particular had a really great approach from my personal point of view, delving deep into the historical sources by Gottfried Hagen, the city writer of that time. So, dear people, in 3 weeks, the next podcast episode is set to be released, but you may have noticed I need a break. I will do what I have always done the past 5 years. I will do a little summer break. So the next episode, in 3 weeks, there will be no new episode. I will take a break, get some rest, maybe get a few rays of sunshine and read a good book. Or play video games. I believe it will be playing video games. And maybe you should do that too. Yeah, that's what I want to tell you. I mean, if you really miss this podcast, we now are nearly at 100 episodes. You can always start from the beginning and see how this podcast has evolved. I don't do that very often, sorry for that, but I'm really happy and glad that you grant me your time and listen to this podcast about a city in some place in Germany. Thank you very much for that. And we will see, or better, hear each other again in 6 weeks. Take care and auf Wiedersehen.